Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Jake Jacobs, visiting Las Vegas from his normal home in Singapore. Jake has been a guest a few times before, talking about his novel called The Battered Butterfly, and also talking about backgammon. Today, he's going to be sharing stories with us from his gambling career over the past 40 years or so. We received an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. An Advantage player wants to know if Richard thinks it's okay to date dealers or pit critters he meets while playing. Richard.
You know, for me, this was always a recipe for disaster. I remember having a very awkward date with a pit boss in Reno one time, where she spent the entire evening calling me Bob and asking me about my real estate business. I
wasn't there, folks.
Right. So for me, I just found this never to be a good thing. And I do know several stories, too, of guys where once the relationship went sour, people ended up ratting them out to casinos and things like that. Although if you're a video poker player, I don't think that's I don't think that's the same problem that a table games player would have.
I turned down a few what might have been golden opportunities just because I was concerned that it wouldn't end well. If you start out with dishonesty in the relationship, where is it going? And I have a friend who was playing in one of the Midwestern Indian casinos, and he was very young at the time and was, using the kind of bratty rich kid act. And I guess that played well with one of the dealers, and he started dating her, and it got more and more serious, and they started talking marriage. And I guess that, his friend started saying, you have to say something. And he let it go until almost the time of the wedding, and he finally told her, my name isn't so-and-so, and, I don't have a lot of money. I play blackjack for a living. And, in the movies, it the third act, they forgive and forget, but no, it didn't work out that way. It was ugly. And kiddies, don't let this happen to you.
Yeah, I my marriage fell apart a couple of years ago, and so I was considering ladies. And I knew, because I'd been playing video poker for almost 20 years, I knew lots of ladies who worked in casinos. And it just, so it was a possibility, but there were just none that I actually thought I wanted somebody away from the gambling world, because many people in the gambling world have money problems because they gamble a lot. And I didn't want a lady who would think I was the solution to her problems, because however much bankroll I have, somebody with money problems can get rid of it. So I kind of avoided that. In Nevada this past week, a bill has been passed by the legislature and signed by the governor to allow skill-based slot machines. We saw a prototype of this at on a pinball variety of a game at last year's G2E. Although expressly marketed as a way to draw young people into a casino, it's actually a way that benefits people who do the work to become good at whatever games that are offered, such as people who listen to this program.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see these machines. This first one that they had at G2E was some sort of pinball slot machine hybrid. but I still don't quite understand how it works, because according to Shaq, no matter how good you get at it, you still can't actually have an edge. So I don't know. I mean, it'll be hard for them to construct a machine that, you know, where you also can't make it so bad for the unskilled player. Like, video poker is a good game because skilled players can play way better, but the bad players, they're not going to play so bad that they're just going to lose their money immediately, you know? So
that's true. Bad players can play at a 95% level or something, and money lasts for a while.
Yeah, so I think it's hard to construct these kind of games, but it'll be interesting to see if they actually create a game where someone could get an edge. And even if you can't get an edge, if you can get close to even money, that would be a great thing too, just, you know, for the cash back and comps and those kind of things.
I wonder, suppose that you had a game where your bet size were based to some extent on your skill. The closer that you were coming to actually winning some money, the more money that you could bet and potentially win. So a really bad player might only be able to put so much in the machine in a given game. But if you started to win, there'd be kind of a parlay option where you could put more money in and, you know, maybe win, you know, double, triple. And, you know, if you started getting even closer to winning, so, you know, if you got to the 99%, you know, 99.9% edge, maybe you'd have, you know, $100 in on the game, whereas if you were playing with that 95%, you'd only have, you know, $5 in.
Well, we do have room in this state for game designers, Jake. so good luck with your new career.
I'm actually thinking about taking that game design class at UNLV, where they, you know, they help you design your games, pay for the patents, you know, have attorneys on as part of the class. I mean, sounds like a good thing.
Sounds like an interesting game. I actually don't have any games in the works. Well, I have a few ideas.
I don't either, but I thought if I got there, something you know, would occur to me as I was taking the class. So.
Well, good. That sounds like it would be fun to take with a buddy, so maybe I'll sign up with it too. Okay. World Series of Poker begins later this week. There's the usual games, and there's a couple of new varieties. One's called the Colossus, where you can re-enter up to four times, and they're expecting something like a total of 20,000 entries with a guaranteed first prize of $5 million, and it's relatively low. It's $500 or something like that. They have another one where the first several rounds you actually play online with the World Series of Poker has an online site here in Nevada, and so when they get down to six, it's going to go move into the Rio, but the first however many hundreds down to six, that's all done online. So we'll see. All right. So, Jake Jacobs, you spent in your Wild and Woolly days a lot of time in Atlantic City. Do you have any interesting stories from your Atlantic City era that you can share with us?
I do, and I will. And I, you know, was running over some of the stories in my mind, and one of the people that I worked with, I was on the team with Tommy Hyland and Bill Benner and, you know, some other guys. They were running the team back in the late 80s, and it was a huge team. There were, I think, 64 people playing at one time. But one of the guys probably has been on the show much, Richard.
Richard has not been on the show, but we've certainly talked about him a lot on the show.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Richard
some of the
has,
things we said, we didn't mention his name.
Okay. Well, he has the distinction of, I think, being number two after Tommy Hyland in the number of arrests accumulated. They used to actually, they'd pick him up at Park Place, the police would, you know, when he was trespassed. They'd haul him in and, you know, he'd pay his fine and then they'd say, can we drop you somewhere? Say, yeah, drop me at Caesars and I'll see you in 30 minutes. And so Richard, you know, had a lot of, he was the guy who was given the unusual jobs on the team. We had this team apartment, the Sweat Lodge in the Ritz. And whenever anything odd was called for, Richard would be sent out, including the infamous phone gobbing. Bill had this, he had discovered this game called phone gobbing. And there was a payphone 15 floors down on the boardwalk, and it was within sight of the binoculars. And they'd put Richard would be sent down, and he'd coat the earpiece with Vaseline. And then they'd wait for a likely looking, you know, the Jersey girls would go walking by, and the phone would ring, and, you know, one of them would stick that phone up against her big hairdo. And then she'd look very puzzled, and she'd start digging in her ear, and that would only push the Vaseline into the ear. And Bill would be rolling around on the floor in, you know, hysterics. And
yeah,
so, this does not sound like an advantage play to me. This sounds like...
Well, the advantage was in the entertainment
factor. Junior high school prank.
Yeah, well, this is the sophistication and the glamour of professional gambling.
Yeah, uh-huh. But one day, now this is, you know, more in the line of business... we had a lot of belts that we used because the computer would transmit to these belts, which were worn in back of the knees. There'd be buzzers in back of the knees that would provide signals from the computer.
I just want to add that computers were legal at this time in Atlantic City. They no longer are, so...
We were running low on batteries, and Richard was the guy with the, you know, soldering equipment, and he was our tinkerer. So I went with him, and Atlantic City, if you've never been there, is, you know, really a pit, and there are all these 99-cent stores and arcades, and we went into one of the 99-cent stores, and there's the woman with the big hair snapping her gum behind the counter, and then there's this guy that is swallowing this, you know, cigar. And, you know, he says, yeah, kid, can I help you? And Richard says, yeah, have you got any C batteries? So, oh, yeah, over here. And he comes up, he's got this box of C batteries. And he said, what are you going to do with the C batteries, kid? You know, because Richard says, I'll take all of them. He's, you know, take all of them. He said, what are you going to do with those C batteries? And Richard said, oh, well... You know, I gave my wife one of those vibrator thingies. And she said, honey, if you bring home some batteries, tonight's the night. And this guy just about swallows a cigar. And he says, you hear that, Mona? Yeah, I heard it. Guy gave his wife one of those vibrator thingies. Yeah, I heard it.
You know, was in Moscow, and I had a travel alarm, and the batteries went dead. And I went out looking for batteries. And I find they have these undergrounds, you know, for crossing the street, and they have little shops down there. So I go into the underground, and they have a pharmacy, and I went in, and I said, I need, you know, AA batteries, and they don't speak any English at all. And
I didn't bring one with me.
It's not an
advantage play, Richard.
No. So I'm trying to say, you know, like a dumb American, you think that they'll understand you if you just say the same word over and over louder. But anyway, I finally get the brilliant idea to ask for a pencil and paper. And the guy gives me a pencil and paper, and I draw a picture of a battery. And there are two guys behind the counter, and the guy says, oh, and he shows it to his friend, and they start talking in Russian, and he reaches under the counter, and he hands me a box of condoms.
Good. Did you tell him it was the wrong size battery? All right.
So, Richard, we were talking about Richard.
Richard, actually, the most unusual mission that he was ever sent on we had a big player that was in his 70s, and Frank, you know, we would accumulate chips because, you know, you want to have plenty of ammo when you go into the casino. And so Frank was, you know, sent in well-armed and had, you know, pockets full of $500 chips. And it turned out that somebody had been counterfeiting chips from this casino. I think it was Trump Castle, maybe. And, you know, so unfortunately Frank had...
I'm asking you not to bang on the table when you're making your point.
Sorry. Frank had, you know, a couple of these counterfeit chips in among his chips, unbeknownst to him. But he got, you know, pulled up at the table and, you know, pulled into the back room. And, you know, the guy was really old. We were worried about, you know, him dropping dead. So they woke up Richard. You know, it was 4 in the afternoon. It wasn't time for breakfast yet, but they woke him up and they said, Richard, you got to go over to the Trump castle and get yourself arrested. You know, get yourself back roomed. And, oh, okay, fine. You know, and his hair standing on end and eyes bright red. And so he hops in a taxi. I mean, just, you know, right out of bed, straight down to the taxi, heads over there, comes running in, you know, and he says, you know, hey, I'm with that guy that you got in the back room. And they said, what guy? He said, well, you got an old guy named Frank in the back room, and I'm with him. Now, in the meantime, Frank had, you know, learned, you know, his lessons well, and he just kept stonewalling. I don't know anything. And, you know, they figured, you know, an old man, he doesn't know anything. And they're all set to let him go, but now they've got this kid outside saying, oh, yeah, he's part of a team. He's on my team. So they haul Richard in, and they've got, you know, the two of them, and they're, you know, interrogating them. And so Richard, you know, tells them, I mean, you know, he's telling it by now it's the state police he's talking to. So he explains that, you know, yeah, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, we got these chips the same way the casino would get them, you know, because they're in circulation. So they the police insist on going back to the sweat lodge. And, you know, they come in and they say, all right, you got any more chips? So, yeah, you know, they bring out, and we've got a briefcase full of chips from all the casinos. And they go through and they found maybe two more counterfeit chips in there. But now they were going up in the ceiling panels. And, you know, they're checking to see if there's a stash of counterfeit chips up there. And for some reason, there was a microfiche machine, you know, sitting there. And so they turned to the least technologically savvy person in the room, Tommy Hyland, and they said, turn that on. And Tommy got up and looked at it with horror, and he said, I wouldn't know how to turn that thing on. And so eventually they, you know, decided that, you know, everything was okay and let everybody go. But now, you know, all the bosses, you know, apparently every casino in town knew that the Sweat Lodge was the nexus of the Highland operations.
So did the Sweat Lodge move immediately thereafter?
Not immediately. We eventually did move down toward, what's the town? Not Mayfair, Margate. Margate. Almost got mugged on the way down to Margate one night, which is kind of an occupational hazard in Atlantic City. I saw them coming and got away, but we had another big player, Rocky, the world's greatest BP. And, you know, Rocky was a little middle-aged Japanese guy, and he's walking down the boardwalk, and this kid who's, you know, teenager, but, you know, a lot bigger than he is, jumped on his back. And as soon as he felt this body hit him, Rocky instinctively dropped to his knees and ducked his head, and the kid went flying over his head. Now, Rocky, about all he knows about martial arts is, you know, from watching the movies like anybody else, but he stood up and went, yeah! And these kids, you know, because there was a gang of them, they looked at him and they went, Mr. Miyagi! They went running off. And
all right.
Being Asian is a superpower.
It is. It is. You've said on this show that being Asian is worth $1 million.
And at least, if not more.
Yeah. But now we had, I mean, being Asian, you know, the advantage is that bosses assume that you're a crazy, superstitious gambler. But we had a couple of, you know, people in Atlantic City that were not Asian but had similar advantages. One of them was a guy that was actually, he had been a member of one of the Philadelphia Eagles Super Bowl teams, which is close to being a demigod as you can be in Atlantic City. And so he got a lot of play. But we also, there was a guy, his name was Calvin, and he was a medical student at Harvard, but, you know, and very buttoned down, Ivy League, but he happened to be black. And so naturally they assumed that he was a cocaine dealer. you know, and he talked like, you know, Teddy Kennedy, but, you know, they just assumed that he was, you know, a cocaine dealer. And so they sent him in against this, there was this dealer, Rosie, who was this enormous, you know, he was like 400 pounds, and he'd get nervous, and he'd sweat all over the table, and there'd be an actual lake on the felt. And so they sent Kelvin in, and Kelvin won $110,000. And, you know, the table, they practically had to take it out and wring it out on the boardwalk afterwards. And so about a month later, they pulled Rosie off the game, and they, you know, put him on Big Six. And, you know, so a month later, they put him back on a blackjack table. And so they immediately sent Kelvin in again, and he won $115,000. And that was his entire blackjack career. Two plays, he won $225,000, and it was another year before they let Rosie touch any cards.
Wow.
I'm surprised they didn't find more use for Kelvin. I mean,
yeah, and I think he had to go back to school.
Yeah. Being a doctor seems kind of tame after after that.
All right. Did you have to do much? Was scouting in Atlantic City different than scouting anywhere else? Or
well, it was because, you know, what we were doing, I mean, as mentioned, we were using computers in those days. And there were dealers. I talked about this. I was on the show previously and mentioned a game called the Memory Game. And, you know, what had happened is they discovered that dealers, some of them, had a move where they would drop clumps of cards and they wouldn't be shuffled. Their hands were out of sync when they riffled. And the depending on how they broke the decks when they shuffle and, you know, how big a clump they produced, this could be, you know, very, very usable. And the computers would look for these strings of unshuffled or barely shuffled cards. So scouting meant that you had to go out and look for riffles, and it was a little, you know, I mean, it was pretty complex. You really had to analyze the shuffle in detail and, you know, watch for the clumps. And so it could take days to scout one shift, and because, you know, people move around. So there was constant scouting opportunity. They paid $20 an hour to scout.
Wow.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I mean, we had a huge book of, you know, lists of dealers, and I found when I was doing scouting that most of the scouts really didn't know what they were looking for. I mean, it wasn't, I'd go in and I'd re-scout people and find out that they were, you know, they were terrible, you know, where they'd been listed as, you know, maybe a four-star dealer. And you know,
man, I'll bet we would have players lined up around the block if we were willing to pay $20 an hour even today, and that was 25 years ago.
Well, they were paying $15 an hour to cash chips, and you'd get another Richards Jobs, but he wasn't the only one. They'd, you know, you'd get not only the $500 and $1,000 chips, but you'd wind up accumulating 25s and 5s and, you know, silvers. And you know, they'd have baggies, you know, and they'd go out with a bag full of baggies of chips from these different casinos. And, you know, sometimes they'd hire a cab to wait for them. And they'd just go around from casino to casino, go in, cash chips, go to the next place, cash chips, and, you know, get rid of the garbage chips. And that was $15 an hour.
How would you make sure these people were honest and wouldn't rip you off if you give them a bag full of a couple thousand dollars worth of chips?
Well,
These people were on the team anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, but the honesty, it is a question. According to we had a team manual, you know, that was a book, and according to the team manual, there were going to be random polygraph tests. Possibly voice stress, I think, was something Mike Mihalik had one time touted. Now, I never, you know, I never went through one of those with that team. I was polygraphed in the early 80s in Las Vegas. We had a team that was losing, and I was the big loser, and it was being refinanced. In fact, Chuck from the Czech team was refinancing. So one of the conditions was that everybody on the team had to go in and get polygraphed. And I went in and early on a Saturday morning, and I, you know, back then I didn't do mornings, so I was kind of half awake. And they were asking, you know, have you tipped? And, you know, how much do you think you've tipped? You know, do you make cover bets? And, you know, the usual sorts of things. And so, you know, I'd probably tipped, I estimated, you know, around $2 or $3, given 50 cents to the cocktail waitress a couple times. And I felt very guilty about that. This was, you know, we had very strict team rules, and I violated them. And, you know, there were times where I probably hadn't, you know, jumped the bet right from, you know, $25 to double 300s or, you know, right back down. You know, so I, you know, it was on my conscience. And I got done, and this guy says, well, you know, he said, do you have any answers you want to change? And I said, no, nothing. And, I mean, I bared my soul to the guy. And he said, well, you know, he said, I think you're lying through your teeth. He said, I think you stole all that money. And that's what I'm going to tell Mr. Goldberg, is that you stole, you know, the $14,000 that I was stuck. And, you know, I was flabbergasted. And he said, now, do you want to think about that? I'm going to go out of the room for 5 minutes. I'll come back. And if you want to change your mind. And, you know, I... boing, and, you know, he came back in, and, you know, he said, well, have you changed your mind? And I said, I can't change my mind because I didn't take any money. I didn't, you know. So I went out immediately, and I called Arthur on the phone, and I said, Art, you know, this guy claims that I'm a thief. and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And apparently they had a team meeting, and they had me retested because nobody, you know, believed the results. And I walked in, and the head of the firm was in there, and he said, you know, I knew you'd be fat. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, you know, I'm a fat guy too. And he said, look at this. And this is when I learned that lie detectors are an out-and-out scam.
They're complete fraud.
Yeah, he brought out the tapes, and he said, "Now, you know, here's the pen registers are supposed to, you know, show this and that." And two of them were just flatline for the whole exam, no reading whatsoever. One of them was completely erratic, and then the third one they kind of had a reading. So, you know, basically the guy had gotten nothing, but there were a couple of things working against me. One was that he didn't understand what blackjack play was. So he assumed that he was supposed to find a thief. And he hadn't found one yet, and I was the last guy tested. And I was also the big loser. So right there, you know, must be me. The other problem was that it turned out that everybody else on the team had been doing all sorts of stuff that was against team policy. They were paying for taxis out of team money. You know, I'd said I tipped about $2 or $3, and I could see that he found that unbelievable. Well, it turned out the team average was $300. That, you know, that they were estimating that they had tipped $300. One guy had paid his rent. You know, people, massive cover bets. You know, just every violation you can imagine. And but, you know, it was a nightmare. And I had, you know, earlier had been asked to play with the Atlantic City group a couple of years before I did. And they had mentioned Mike, you know, was gung-ho on testing and had mentioned that, you know, testing would be a regular feature. And I just said, you know, I'm not interested in joining any team that does that.
It's funny when you mention Mike because I want to get into when you're talking about paying people for these things and polygraphs, about kind of how teams get organized. But before we go into that, you know, I was on a team with Mike, and we also had very strict rules. And
and you polygraphed.
And Mike went down to Aruba, and he lost like $120,000 or something.
The dump truck.
Yes. And we flew him back to Vegas to polygraph him. And you know, it turned out, you know, we had these rules. No cover betting off the top. Were you betting off the top? Yes, but it's okay. You know, no tipping. Were you tipping? Yes, but it's okay. And here's why. No drinking when you're playing. Were you drinking? Yes, but I can have one or two and play. You know, so it was like every rule in the book he had violated except for stealing. He wasn't stealing. He was just playing in a way that was against the rules that had this huge variance, you know. And I mean, we ended up giving him more money and sending him back down there, but it did end up breaking up the team because of you know, what's the point of deciding what the rules are going to be if you don't think any of them apply to you, you know. But yeah, so how do you like, who comes up with this? How to pay? Let's pay these people $15 an hour, and how do you compensate people fairly? And still, the big problem the teams seem to have is when the team starts losing, people don't want to go out and play. They lose their incentive.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that you know, the ideal teams, the team that you were on with Mike, started out with six guys that each put up $10,000.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, was a professional, was motivated, and, you know, would go out and play. Of course, you were successful, which helped. There was another team around at the time, you know, Daryl and Craig and that crowd, that very, very similar. You know, guys had been together for years, small group, all pros.
And, all putting up investments.
And they would literally break bankrolls by going to a hotel room, and everybody would empty their pockets on the bed, and they'd go one for you and one for you and one for you and one for me. And that was, you know, how they'd split things up at the end of a bankroll. So those teams, you know, work really well if you've got people that are professional and everybody knows each other and trusts each other. But the team that I was on where I got polygraphed was a much, much bigger team. Arthur had been a player, and then he got completely burned out and he couldn't play. You know, he was just too well-known. He had a lot of money and enough for a bankroll. And so he decided that this was the next thing. He'd be a financier, and he didn't know how to run a team and didn't, you know, so he had people that were experienced and were excellent players, and he had people that were, you know, beginners. And so they were learning on the job. And, you know, he was giving everybody money and sending them out and, you know, go do your thing. And, you know, during that time, we were getting into some more complex plays, you know, hole card plays and
shuffle tracking.
A little bit of shuffle tracking later, although I think Jim and I were probably the only ones that ever really on that time on the team that were.
Well, I actually started out briefly on Arthur's team, and the reason that I moved, they recruited me to go to the other team, was they didn't want me teaching everybody on Arthur's yeah. team how to shuffle track. So,
yeah, but the difference with Tommy's team now, around the time that we were all playing in Vegas in the early 80s, there was a big fight, the Holmes-Cooney fight. It was one of those sort of landmarks in blackjack history. I mean, everybody was in town for it. And Tommy's team came in, and the story that we heard was that they were taught to just, you know, bet a quarter, and then as soon as the count hit either true two or 2-3, start, you know, blazing away at their maximum unit. It was like quarter and then double 500s and play double 500s to the end of the shoe. And I had also heard that they trained the big players so that they only knew they didn't know index numbers. They just knew a true two basic strategy. So they'd play, you know, no matter what the count, they were playing as though it was a true two.
Well, they'd have to know something about – they probably knew whether to take insurance or not. Maybe it was a true three basic strategy.
Could be. And, yeah, so they came in well-funded, 28 players one weekend. They won $350,000. Now, at that time, Munch's team was, you know, playing with $60,000 bankroll, and they were taking a payday every 20. They were getting a lot of paydays, but, you know, every 20 they'd, you know, take a payday. The Arthur team that was struggling along, trying to double a $40,000 bankroll, you know, was going for months. And here Tommy comes in and boom, $350 in one weekend. And, but, you know, what they did there was that they rigidly disciplined all those players, and they didn't give them a lot of latitude. In the later days in Atlantic City, they'd had a lot of time to, you know, think about how they were going to do all this. And they were really, really big on calculating expected value and paying things based on expected value. So it was organized like a, you know, like a business, like a fairly good sized business. And for instance, when I played the memory game, you know, we had the lock winners, you know, the positive EV, and we knew exactly how much positive EV had been generated. But then on the negative EV, you calculate, you know, well, you're playing so many hours of non-lock winners, and you're playing in an average bet of this, and the people that are coming in that are, you know, memorizing hands are, you know, playing a little bit at, you know, 100 a pop, you know, and their negative EV is this, and so it was all calculated. And then they'd say, in my case, it was 15% of EV. So I'd generated a net of, my positive EV was 38.5. And the overall negative was, you know, about 17, 18. So they said, okay, you know, so it's 20,000 EV, and you get 3,000, 15%.
That seems low to me. But I guess if they have all those support people, you got, yeah, you have computer people and – yeah, you have a lot of people to pay.
And I also had the opportunity while I was there. You know, I did some of the scouting. I did some, you know, chip cashing. And you'd get paid, for instance, on some of the computer plays on the floor. There could be as many as 15 people involved in one play because you'd have what they called the gallery. You know, the inputters would rotate so that you didn't see the same person inputting. And to cover up what they were doing, people would stand – they were standing behind with the computer, and they'd be inputting in their pocket. So you'd have two or three people that would be standing in front of them, blocking the pit's view of the inputter whose hand was, you know, in his or her pocket.
That's also where they took to having the prosthetic arm, so it looked like the...
That was later. We moved the inputter back onto the table with the prosthetic arm, which got rid of the gallery, cut down on... and that, you know, when we were doing the stuff at the table, you'd usually have a three-man play. So you put a big player at first base playing two spots, and then the input would be sitting in the middle of the table with her fake arm, and then we'd get a guy on third base. And the third baseman would be wearing the belt that got the signals and would signal the big player on how much to pay, how much to bet. But they had another duty. With the computer, it was predicting whether small cards, medium cards, big cards, or really big cards were going to be coming next. So you actually didn't know what was coming, and so the third baseman would, depending on what was coming, either avoid taking cards or would take cards. And one time I'm sitting there at the table, and there was this dealer that was just, you know, really, really obnoxious. And so he was playing up to the big player. He was flirting with the inputter, Tommy's sister. And With the fake arm. And then he thought that, they would be entertained if he gave me a hard time. So he was picking on me constantly. And I just sat there with my head down. And so this hand came up. And, I've got a 5 up. I've got a 15. And the dealer's got a 6 up. And, sometimes if it was like low or neutral, we didn't always have to eat cards. And so for a change of pace, I thought, okay, I'll just, I'll stand. And he said, "What's the matter? You're not going to hit that?" And I signaled, "I'm standing." And he's,
"This is 15 against a 6.
15 against a 6, because he'd seen me hit similar hands for the previous hour, And so, at this one time I thought, okay, I'll, change up a little bit. I had the, the option of doing that. And I signaled again, "No, I'm standing." And, no, "You're not going to hit. You're not going to hit that." "All right, screw it," So I started scratching. "Okay, give me the card." And he goes, "What are you doing? You're going to hit? You're going to hit 15 against a 6? So I scratch again. He says, "You're not really hitting 15 against a 6. And I scratch again. And finally, there was this boss that he kept calling Gumby. And, the boss obviously was not in control of the situation. But the boss finally asserted himself. And he said, "Look, he wants a card. Give him a card." And he gives me a 5. And then he turns over a 10 in the hole and proceeds to bust. And he's now steaming. And the boss starts laughing at him. And he says, "You probably think he took that card because he was counting."
Did the casino ever pick off the fake arm?
Oh, yeah. Eventually, they were always looking for computers. And, that's what they looked for. And they had, the magic shoes were by that time, long gone. They'd look for the shoes. Okay, no shoes. So then they learned, okay, inputters stand behind the table. They'd look for the inputter behind the table. They had one place, they had a guy, the meter man. And the meter man would, come around, and if you tuned a radio to, in between stations, and then he'd put the earphones on, and he'd bring the radio up close to somebody he thought was the inputter. And if he was right, he'd get all this feedback. And so actually that was a designated job, was the person who watched for the meter man in Park Place.
I know a guy who was playing with Keith and Marty Taft at the time, and they built a wheelchair that this guy was – he's a small guy, and he was lying down under the seat of the wheelchair with his legs up behind the back of the wheelchair – looking through some kind of a periscope-type device that came out the top of the wheelchair, and he would do all the inputting
There was
actually a person sitting in the wheelchair that was sitting on top of him, basically. And, he would be in there inputting because, as you say, they were constantly looking for people – with computers and inputting and trying to figure out where they could be.
Weren't you at a blackjack ball one time where there was a rumor that Keith had his 15-year-old daughter in an air conditioning duct for for 48 hours for some play?
Yeah, it turned out it was not his daughter. It was this same guy. They ended up finding some kind of an access door up at the top, up 3 or 4 floors in Bally's, and they opened this door and they found they could go out across the casino floor. There are like pilings and stuff up there. And he would spend days up in the ceiling with binoculars,
I called.
What could you see with binoculars for on top?
The cards. And he could input the computer.
Yeah.
And there would be nobody around the big player.
They had an optometric and ophthalmologic institute in Philly that I called and talked to the head of the department, you know, because I wanted to see if we could build glasses that, you know, were binoculars. Because Bally's had this four-story escalator. So you could see the tables from up there, but you couldn't see the cards by a mile. I mean, you're up way up in the air and, you know, probably 150 feet or more from the table. And I thought, you know, if you could get these binocular glasses, but, you know, he said, no, you know, they'd look like binocular glasses. They wouldn't look like...
I wonder if you just had, like, a little telescope in your hand, if you could just... stand up there. You'd be so far away. I mean, the
Popeye
boss
the sailor
to...
man.
Yeah. Have my own story on this area. I used to play a gambler spree at the Riviera. This would be early 90s. And they would give out coupons where $50 if you could get five cards less than 21. And they were good on any of the tables. So I was able to get like 30 of these, then play at the $2 table. So when you're playing at the $2 table and it's a $50 bonus if you get this hand, you're making a lot of weird plays. So I have this four card 17 and I'm hitting for another card. Didn't matter what the dealer had, I didn't care. And this dealer was refusing to give it to me. This was the kind of a dealer who was play everybody hands for them to help them. She would have approximate basic strategy, and she felt she was doing a favor. And so she would not give me a card to hit 15. And so I'm going,
17.
Hit 17. And she just refused. And I kept hitting. And she eventually gives the next person a 3. And so I'm screaming, you know, to the pit. You know, everybody saw that I wanted the card, and she refused to give it. And so the pit boss comes over and he goes, "Well, I can't take the cards back. Do you want the next card or not?" So I said yes, and it turned out to be a low card, so I was able to succeed. But she could not understand that she was dealing blackjack, but I wasn't playing blackjack.
Right, yeah.
All right, so let me take a break and do a few commercials. And we got several more stories for Jake as he goes down memory lane. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returned 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Mondays through Thursday, through the end of this month, which is Thursday of this week. Play 300 points before 1 p.m., get a lunch buffet. 600 points before 8 p.m., get a dinner buffet. You can earn both lunch and dinner buffets on the same 600 points as long as you do the first part before 1 p.m. Double points with last night, which is why I'm groggy today. I had a 14-hour day on the quick quads. This month, they're giving away extra free play if they have your email address. And the free play is a significant bonus. It goes up to $150 a week extra. And so if they don't have your email address, they bribe you well to get it. So I recommend if you play that you give them your email address, you will get
email,
but they pay you for it. All right. At the Palms, they have weekly 7 p.m. drawings on every Friday. Winners share $10,000. Don't need to be there. Need to claim it by midnight. They have multiple entries to the tournament Friday afternoon and then more so on Friday evening. PFP, Play for Prizes, through May 28th, which is this coming Friday. It will be fresh and easy gift cards. That is a supermarket that's in Nevada and a few other western states. The gift cards may be earned and redeemed Monday through Friday at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your points. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year. You get your correction on games where the correction isn't found anywhere else. Quick Quads is one example. They have a game of the week, and it happens to be Quick Quads. Seems to be a theme today. Quick Quads is a 6-coin per line game where you get extra quads or four of a kind, where you have 3 matching cards and the other 2 add up. to that card, such as 10-10-10-7-3 or 6-6-6-5-ace, and you get paid as a four of a kind. And it's fun. It's my game of choice at the South Point, and I play it heavily, and it's a good game.
14 hours you played, huh?
Yeah.
Better man than I, Gunga Din.
I'm a dragon man today. A lot of people get wasted on Memorial Day, and I did, but not in the same way that everybody else did. I could do that easier when I was younger. All right. So were there any we're talking to Jake Jacobs on through his memory lane of stories. Was your team ever hijacked or lose money?
I mentioned Rocky getting mugged, but we never had that kind of thing. I did have in what we were talking about. I noticed I had notes on two cleanup anecdotes that kind of cover Atlantic City, cover the waterfront, and cover team organization.
Okay, go.
The first one, the shorter one, was just this: they were playing the 3-man team, and it's barely possible. It was the same session with the the obnoxious dealer, but it was the same lineup. And actually the big player was Frank, the old man in his late 70s who had gotten himself back roomed with the counterfeit chips, which kind of comes into it. So I'm there with Sue Highland and Frank, and we're playing away, and Frank all of a sudden gets it had to be a different dealer. Frank gets a 12 against a 3, and he looks at that, and he says 12 against a 3, and he kind of remembered basic strategy. He knew a little more than some of the we had trained the big players so that they weren't supposed to worry about this kind of nuance, but he kind of knew that this was an index play because he'd been around a long time. So he said 12 against a 3. He said I think that's a double down. And so as a good third baseman, I and which was the signal, no, it's not. And so he said, yeah.
You guys didn't have any hand signals for
a cough indicated you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, but you didn't have hand signals for double.
Oh no, splits. They were expected to know how to play all the hands.
Oh, okay.
We only signaled the
bet,
the exceptions.
Bets.
Okay.
Yeah. So he says, dealer. He said, but he's looking at me, and he said, dealer, isn't 12 against a 3? He said, aren't you supposed to double that down? And the dealer says, well, sir, I really can't say. And he said, I'm sure I remember something about 12 against a 3 being a double down. And Sue Highland goes, and he said, yeah, dealer. He said, don't you think? Don't you remember? And, and so Sue and I wound up going, and we're shaking our heads no in unison as we're going, and he looks at us, and now his eyes light up, and he said, yeah, it is a double down, and he had $800 out there, and he shoves out another $800 and doubles down, 12 against a 3, and naturally he catches a 7, and the dealer gets a 5 on his 13, so, Frank wins $1,600 and is pleased as punch that, he's gotten one right, but...
Yeah, I find it better, the signals become so obvious when you do those kind of things. I find it better to just do what a tourist would do and say, no, I wouldn't double 12 against a 3. Are you crazy? Just hit it.
Didn't Phil one time signal, it was the same signal for doubled and split, and so guy had a pair of 9s against a 9, and he signals and the guy doubled down 18.
That might not be a good play.
Yeah.
So the other kind of the cleanup on this subject was team organization, and we talked about the team pulling the money out and counting it on the blanket. Well, they'd brought in Alan Woods. The late Alan Woods was an investor in this team in Korea, and I get a call. I'm in Korea. They call me from Reno, and they're trying to. Break the bankroll, but they're actually trying to break about 3 bankrolls because we'd been winning so much that they'd gotten a little behind. And not only had they gotten a little behind, but there were, travel expenses, there were exchange rates, there were all sorts of, little wrinkles. So they sat down to break these banks, and they found that they were off by $89,000, which, you know, they're on a $100,000 bankroll, so this is kind of a big error. And so they are working on it, and they call me, you know, and they're on the phone with me, and they're going, well, you know, now your notes are impeccable, but do you remember what Gabe did when he was there in, you know, Korea? And I, well, yeah, I kind of think he did this and that. And so they spend 15 hours. And at the end of 15 hours, they've gotten it down to $14,000. And they've decided that $7,000 of it is probably money change. And that actually is an accounting bugaboo, is dealing with currency. It's hard to deal with, you know, even for businesses that have to deal with it. But, you know, for a blackjack team that's not used to it, you know, how do you account for it? So, but they figure, okay, so there's still $7,000. And it just happens that Phil has a Caesars Tahoe cocktail napkin, and it's got $7,000 written on it. And his argument is that, you know, he wouldn't have written it down if it wasn't important. So this is evidence that he gave Alan the $7,000. And
well, what had happened was we had loaned Alan seven. He was in Reno with Malcolm. They were running Canadian currency from Canada to Reno, and we happened to be up there playing, and a chouette broke out.
Chouette is backgammon
for more than one person. And they needed some extra U.S. dollars, and we had given them $7,000. And Alan, now again, it's years later and many bankrolls, Alan swore he had paid us back the $7,000 in Korea. And that's what this whole $7,000 discrepancy was.
So at this point, they'd called for a committee hearing, and we've got other blackjack players involved. And the inimitable and sorely missed Malcolm Sims stands up, and in his best, you know, prosecutorial voice, he says, "Now, Mr. Sims, or Mr. Woods, isn't it true that sometimes when you take a loss that you would go back up to your room and you would spank the monkey?" And Alan says, "Yes." And he said, "And isn't it true further that one time you were so excited that you placed your Johnson in the champagne ice bucket?" And Alan says, "Well, yes, Malcolm." He said, "All that's true, but what's that got to do with anything?" And Malcolm says, "Nothing, but I love that story."
Yeah, if you want more details on that story, I actually wrote it up years ago. It's called The Case of the Missing $7,000, and you can find it on my website at richardmunchkin.com. You may have to hunt around a little, but it's there.
The first time I heard the story was the first time I ever heard Johnson used in that fashion, so maybe I so now we're on internet radio, we can say Johnson where we couldn't on the AM radio. I'm not sure. Yeah. All right, Richard, we have about a minute left. Where can people find our podcast?
Right, we welcome your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. You can post questions there, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. If you want the show delivered to you automatically every week, you can sign up for that at iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. Or for an archive of every old episode, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
All right. We thank Jake Jacobs. It was an interesting stroll down memory lane. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good afternoon.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Views and opinions expressed on this program were those of the hosts and guests and did not necessarily reflect those of Vegas All Net Radio, its affiliates, or its parent company.